Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, our Friday news cap on abortion restrictions, legislative immunity, and more, and the personal impact of DEI cuts on college campuses. But first, Arizona's longest-serving congressman has died. Raul Grijalva passed away from complications from cancer treatment yesterday. He was 77. A longtime fixture in Tucson politics, Grijalva served in the House of Representatives since 2002, championing environmental protection, immigrants' rights, and public education throughout his long career. Until last year, he served as the ranking member of the House's Natural Resources Committee, fighting to stop mining across the state, including near the Grand Canyon, and to preserve the natural beauty of the Sonoran Desert. The son of an immigrant who came to America as part of the Bracero program, Grijalva was outspoken on immigration. In 2010, he led the fight against the notorious Show Me Your Papers law, SB 1070, to the point that he called for a boycott of Arizona after it was passed and suffered the political consequences. But he never changed his fundamental views.
In this country, we have blended families. We have families that are being divided. We have families that are being broken up, and the anguish and anxiety in many communities is palatable, and it's across the country.
Grijalva was outspoken about most of his political beliefs, known for his blunt style and staunch progressive positions. Last year, he announced he was undergoing treatment for cancer, and he missed most of the votes this year as well. Now let's turn to someone who served alongside him for years representing Arizona, former longtime Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. Before he was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2012, he served for a decade alongside Grijalva in the House, and he joins us on the line now to talk more about it. Good morning, Ambassador Flake.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. So you and Grijalva were on opposite sides of the aisle, obviously, and he was known as something of a firebrand. Tell us a little bit about your relationship.
He was. He was a very progressive member of Congress, and he wasn't shy about his beliefs. But he was a kind man, and I always got along with him well. And I remember our interactions fondly, particularly on the Resources Committee. We served together there. And he ultimately took, the chairmanship of that committee, important committee, especially important to Arizona. Mm-hmm. And from that perch, he had a lot to do with environmental policy and some of the issues that he felt strongly about.
Tell me a little bit about any chances you had to work together on those issues. Were there moments when, you know, a Republican and a Democrat like Grijalva came together and did something, you know, important for the state, for the Southwest?
Well, you bet. You mentioned in the intro his concern about immigration. I shared that concern that we needed comprehensive immigration reform. And from the time I started in the House, I was trying to work across the aisle. That took the form, many forms, but he was always willing to work across the aisle in that regard, particularly when President Bush, from the White House, was eager to do immigration reform. Raul Grijalva was willing to work across the aisle there, and we had many discussions during that time. I say on environmental issues, you worked, and land use issues, you worked closely across the aisle for Arizona's sake.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about working with him and working with him as someone from the opposing party, especially. I mean, like you said, he was a kind man. You worked together well. He was willing to do, you know, bipartisanship in a way that maybe doesn't exist in the same way today. What was he like personally?
Well, personally, let me just give you one anecdote. He wasn't much for a lot of the Washington social scene or events, and including the White House Christmas ball, and there were 8 years of, President Bush, 6 years when he was there. And, I always had family members who wanted to attend, but, you know, it was only the member plus one. And so Raul Grijalva was kind enough to let me use his plus one many times. And so many of my children have gone to the White House Christmas ball as guests of Raul Grijalva, or as the plus one when he simply didn't attend. And he would even call a few months before just to say, hey, do you have any kids that need to go? And he was always, always kind that way. And I got along well with him.
That's interesting. I want to ask about something I've been reading a lot about in remembrances of Congressman Grijalva over the last day or so here. Lots of folks saying, you know, he never changed his beliefs with the political winds. Like he just wasn't a creature of Washington in that way. Did you experience that with him?
You bet. He was unapologetically progressive, and he didn't change his views. So, but it didn't mean that he was obstinate or angry. We got along well, and like I said, we have so many issues in Arizona that you need to work across the aisle on. And so we had many delegation meetings back, just before he got there. Bob Stump was the dean of the delegation, and then Senator McCain. Mm-hmm. And I remember a lot of those delegation meetings quite fondly, and his participation in them. Yeah. Because he was committed to Arizona. He had, like you said, many different views than I had, but we worked together when we could. And that kind of typified how Congress has been in the past, and I hope we get back to that model.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that way right now. I want to ask you about something else. When you announced your retirement in 2017, Grijalva said at the time that, you know, he wasn't going to do the same anytime soon, that it was, I think the quote was, it was time to right the ship, he told Arizona Public Media at the time. He wanted to stay and fight, basically. What did you think about that?
Well, that just typified, his approach. He served, 50 years in public service, from, I think, school board to start with, the county board of supervisors, and then on to Congress. And, that was his life. So he wasn't about to take a different role. He had a position of power and influence, particularly when he chaired the Resources Committee, and he wasn't about to give it up.
Hmm. Last question for you then, and just a forward-looking one as we're remembering the congressman today. What do you predict his legacy will look like?
Well, like I said, 50 years. he's going to be remembered for his commitment to Arizona, for his commitment to environmental causes, to immigration, and the kindness he showed toward migrants. He knew their story well because he lived it. And I think that's what he'll be remembered for.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, Ambassador Flake as well. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Grijalva will no doubt be remembered as a pioneer in environmental preservation, as we just heard. He chaired the House Natural Resources Committee and championed preservation across the Southwest. And our next guest worked alongside him during those issues throughout his career. Sandy Barr is director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, and she joins me now in studio to talk more about him. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
So Grijalva got the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan passed back when he was, before he even served in Congress, when he was serving on the Pima County Board of Supervisors, right? Talk a little bit about the inspiration, where you think his passion came for fighting for environmental issues.
Well, first and foremost, he put people first always and recognized that people are part of the environment. But I think also, his heart was in the Sonoran Desert, and he loved it, and he really was visionary in putting forth the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, something that really has happened nowhere else, and that has protected a lot of the lands in Pima County. And as supervisor, he helped to push through the plan and funding, and it's won many awards and been recognized as something that really had bipartisan support as well on the County Board of Supervisors.
You've known him since then, right?
Yes, yes.
A long career in all of this, and so much has happened, right? Like, he's passed landmark legislation that he authored and also got passed from the National Landscape Conservation System Act, the Federal Lands Restoration Act, the Environmental Justice for All Act. I'm sure all of these mean a lot to you. In your mind, Sandy, like, what are some of his most notable accomplishments on this front?
Well, I think, I want to I want to say that he brought environmental justice to the forefront, and he also brought the voices of many tribal communities, indigenous leaders, to the forefront. And that is something that we really hadn't seen. And it wasn't like he was saying, having them be part of it just because he wanted to have a diverse coalition. It was because he recognized that their voices were really important. And so I think that is super important. His work on protecting the Grand Canyon region, and he was instrumental in getting the Bajj Nawabjo Itakukvini Ancestral Footprints of the Grand Canyon National Monument established. And he helped lead that effort through several administrations. That work started back when Obama was president, and working with 14 tribes to help make that happen. And then President Biden established that in 2023. That was huge. He's fought for protecting Oak Flat. He fought the land exchange. And pretty much every session has introduced the Save Oak Flat Act. And again, that is, that's an environmental issue, but it's also an religious freedom issue, environmental justice issue. The San Carlos Apache have been fighting alongside him on that for a very long time. So he has been instrumental in so many things. And like I said, he's always put people first.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the first to hold congressional hearings on missing and murdered Indigenous women. It sounds like he was really a trailblazer in including tribal voices, as you're pointing out there.
Absolutely. I remember being in D.C. when Deb Haaland chaired the subcommittee, and he was chair of the Natural Resources Committee, and they were hearing a bill to protect the lands around Grand Canyon. And there was a news conference, and, you know, the nation's capital was in the background, and all these Indigenous leaders, and he was inspirational, but at the same time so down to earth and so, like, giving everyone hugs. He always made time for just, you know, the average person who would be stopping by in D.C. One of our staff who was just there with her son, you know, just wanted to stop in and say hello. He made time to meet with them and meet with her son. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that have those little things have lasting impact.
Yeah. Yeah. He invited you to testify in Congress once?
My only time testifying in Congress was when he chaired the subcommittee, and it was on Oak Flat. And I was so afraid and also so honored to be part of that. And, you know, he was so gracious and supportive. And like I said, from the beginning was working to protect that area. And there were several Indigenous leaders on that panel as well. So, yeah, I'll never forget that either. And of course, I got a hug, too.
Always hugging. I like that.
Yeah.
I want to ask about some of the wins and losses, right? Because this is, you know, he's probably had a number of both over the course of his career, right? Not always winning on these environmental issues. Sometimes the mines are, you know, are allowed to go forward, and he fought against them, that kind of thing. Why do you think he kept at it?
Well, he thought it was important. And I think that's the sign of a true leader, someone who is willing to take on the tough issues. It's easy to do something when you have everyone who supporting it and you know you have the votes. But on the issues where, you know, maybe it's a little tougher, I mean, immigration, that is not an easy issue. He was willing to take that on and be part of it. On protecting Oak Flat, you know, the bill went through Congress. It had the support of Senator John McCain, but Congressman Grijalva was willing to continue to fight for that area, even when it seemed like the fight was over. And I think he was really passionate about protecting the land, but also always connecting the land with the people. And I think that kept him going. He just had a good center for what was right, what was important, and he was persistent. He was fighting till the end. I mean, he really was fighting till the end, pushing back against the Trump administration, even when he was very sick.
Yeah, we kept getting statements. Exactly. It never stopped. I want to ask you before I let you go about your personal relationship with Raul Grijalva. And you said he would always give a hug, but you knew him for, 20, 30 years, maybe. I mean, this is a long time. What was he like to work with personally?
He was very warm. He was direct, which I appreciated. I had a wonderful sense of humor. I can hear his laugh right now. He was kind, but he also would have sometimes these little funny digs that he would, when someone was being pompous or something like that. And yeah, he always made people feel welcome. I always felt like I was heard, and obviously we agreed a lot of times because we were both advocating for conservation, but I never felt like he was just going through the motions. He would take time. You would have like a half hour meeting and it would be an hour and a half, and he would tell stories. He would listen to your stories as well. Young people, when they would come in and they were new, one of our staff was brand new to lobbying, and it was her first experience. And, what a great first experience lobbying with Congressman Grijalva. Just a wonderful, kind person who will be missed so much.
Yeah. All right. Will be missed. Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, joining us. Sandy, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Now it's time for our Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
And they wanted to weaponize this against a member of the legislature and stop us from being able to cast a very important vote on a very important piece of legislation. They would be able to do that if we get rid of this.
Our folks are a constituent. They get stopped. They get tickets because they are speeding on their way to work or wherever they are going. So are we better than the people who send us here, who follow the very laws that we make?
This includes the 24-hour waiting period, reporting restrictions, telehealth ban, et cetera, all unnecessary restrictions that just don't allow people to gain full access to abortion care.
When I was flying over Iraq getting shot at, or flying in the space shuttle, never once for a second did I think somewhere down the road somebody's gonna call me a traitor.
This morning, I'm joined by attorney Tom Ryan and former state Republican lawmaker Regina Cobb. Good morning to you both. Thank you both for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, let's start with just a moment of reflection on Congressman Raul Grijalva and his life and legacy in Arizona. Just give you both a chance to say what you wanted to say there. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, thank you. First off, what an impressive legacy Representative Grijalva has left. He was a giant in the field down in Tucson, very, very involved in the community and very important in the immigration issue. Our longest-serving congressman has just passed, and very sad. So condolences to his family and to the community and to the congressional district that he served.
Regina?
Yeah, I would agree with Tom. What a legacy. 20 years plus, and 12-term congressman has done some impressive things, and I'm sure his family and friends are mourning now. We're all sad for it.
Yeah, and there will be much more to come on a special election that will select his replacement in Congress. That's all coming soon. But let's leave that there for now and move on to some Arizona politics for the week. I want to start with an essay from Arizona Supreme Court Justice Clint Bolick that's been making some waves. It kind of went after what he sees as an assault on what's happening on judicial independence, right? Now, Bolick is a conservative. He was appointed by Doug Ducey. He's not who you might expect to see going hearing after the Trump administration's approach to the courts. But he also did not name Trump in this essay. You know, he didn't say, you know, his specific concerns there. He said the courts are under attack from both the left and the right's political agendas. Tom, I want to start with you here and just do you think he's trying to walk a line? Is that a line that's possible to walk right now?
Well, he's trying to walk the line, but the line is not that clear, because what's happening is Trump is definitely making an assault upon not just the federal judiciary, but the state judiciary as well. And it's not just his comments about the judiciary that are doing damage. For example, there was a hearing yesterday in a federal court in Northern California where the Department of Justice attorney that's appointed under the Trump administration was filing sham affidavits. The court went through the roof. And in fact, the court literally ruled from the bench something judges rarely do, and said, you don't wait for a written order from me. This is my order now. Everybody is getting rehired in the federal government. The judiciary is under assault, but it's mostly coming from Trump and Trump acolytes. And that's a very dangerous thing.
Regina, he did outline some specific things that the Trump administration and his allies have done lately, like, you know, threatening to impeach judges, defying court orders, arguing the president's power is higher than the court's power, essentially, really kind of challenging the balance of power. Talk a little bit about your impressions here of what this looks like from the Republican perspective.
Well, I want to talk about how it is from my perspective,
sure,
not just Republican perspective. I think that I do like some of the things that Trump is putting in place. I mean, we've had a lot of waste, but our forefathers put out a constitution and designed it for the separation of powers. And I think that that's a good thing. And Justice Bullock is, if you go back, he makes waves, and he doesn't really care that he's making waves. He just does what he thinks is right. Justice Bullock, I respect him probably more than any justice that we've had. And so I feel like he needs to – he's trying to toe that line, but he came out with a good op-ed. I thought it was great.
There's a very powerful scene in the movie Judgment at Nuremberg between Burt Lancaster and Spencer Tracy. Spencer Tracy was the fictional prosecutor in that trial, mm-hmm. and Burt Lancaster was the chief justice of the German Supreme Court. And he wanted to talk to Spencer Tracy as basically playing Justice Jackson. And he told him, you have to understand, we never saw this coming. We never, you know, this wasn't what we planned. And Spencer Tracy's great walkaway line in that was, you knew it was coming the first time you condemned an innocent man. So when we see our judiciary being under assault and the destruction of the balance of power going on, it's something that should frighten every American Republican or Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've heard the phrase constitutional crisis come up over and over again in recent interviews in recent weeks, Regina. I want to ask you about that. Like, do you think that's where we're headed, this idea that the balance of power is severely threatened?
I don't. I think that you will see the balance of power happen. And that's why our forefathers designed it the way they designed it. You've seen things go the other direction also, where our judicial system has actually legislated from the bench. Mm. So I think that there's got to be a balance. You're going to see the pendulum swing.
Yeah. Tom, what do you think about that? Because this is a critique I've heard also, that it's not like we haven't seen the judiciary kind of do the same thing.
Oh, we've seen it on both sides. I agree with that. But there's a difference between being judicially active and then destroying the balance of power. Those are not the same concepts. Yes, there was judicial activism under the Berger and Warren courts, but there's also been lots of judicial activism, Citizens United, Holder, Shelby versus Holder. I mean, there's a whole bunch of cases that were just made up out of whole cloth on both sides. That's not this issue. The issue is you don't get to tell me what to do. How are you going to enforce that ruling, judge? That's the kind of thing that's what we really should be talking about.
Mm. All right. I want to move on to the state capitol, where state lawmakers are actually voting to get rid of their own legislative immunity, or some of them. This all started with a number of lawmakers invoking legislative immunity in order to get out of traffic tickets, like speeding tickets, where they're really going pretty far over the limit. One Republican representative, Quan Nguyen, wrote a bill getting rid of it, or at least when it comes comes to traffic tickets, getting rid of this immunity. Regina, you were a state lawmaker. You enjoyed this legislative immunity. Are you surprised that lawmakers voted to advance this proposal this week?
No, I'm not surprised at all. This is an archaic immunity that we've had in place for a long time. And it was put in place years ago to protect the legislators from not being able to vote. And I don't think we have that issue any longer. We're not having a police officer stopping somebody on the side of the road to keep them from doing a vote. So it really should be revoked. I personally have had speeding tickets during my legislative session. I am, and I'm going to put it out.
Yes.
But I paid them. I didn't ask anybody to forgive them, and I paid them during session. So I feel like this is if I get pulled over for speeding, I'm a citizen just like everybody else.
I mean, Tom, we heard some arguments being made from some lawmakers when this was debated this week, saying that, you know, this prevents the governor from weaponizing law enforcement against legislators, like Regina described there. Are there real reasons, though, you think, that lawmakers might need to speed, might need to get to the Capitol really fast for a really important vote?
Absolutely not. And Regina is correct. The purpose is to the purpose of the immunity is to keep the governor or the executive branch from keeping somebody from voting. Most of the high-profile things we've seen, though, on these are, for example, former Senator Justine Wadsack down in Tucson. She was going home. There was no need to speed. And her idea of why she had to speed, her electric car was running out of juice. Well, then you don't go faster, you go slower. And the same thing with Mark Fincham. It wasn't part of his duties to speed. So, no, they need to get rid of that. I applaud Senator Wynn for saying, let's get rid of this. It should be gotten rid of.
Yeah. I want to ask you the last question here, Regina, about sort of the taste this leaves in voters' mouths, right? Like what it does for the reputation of lawmakers when it seems like, you know, they think they are above the law.
I totally agree. I think that it does give a bad taste in their mouth. And Senator Wynn or Representative Wynn is a very common sense kind of guy. And if somebody was going to be, you know, traveling a lot, it's him. He comes from a rural area and travels and knows this better than anybody else. I think that it just you have to be on the same page as the citizens. And this isn't and this puts us one step above. I would never even put a license plate, you know, they have a license plate cover that says that you're a legislator. I'm a poor driver, so I would say that I would probably people would not like me even more if they saw that on my license plate.
the most famous line is, "Do you know who you're pulling over?"
Yes.
Well, I appreciate you admitting to that. Thank you. All right, that is former state lawmaker Regina Cobb, lawyer Tom Ryan. We will be back with more of the Friday Newscap after the break. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger, and we're back with the Friday Newscap, joined by Regina Cobb and Tom Ryan this morning. Another big story at the state capitol this week I want to talk about is sort of the around the future of abortion rights in our state. Like this seemed pretty clear last year when voters pretty overwhelmingly approved Prop 139, enshrining abortion rights in the state constitution. But there are still a whole host of laws that remain on the books in Arizona that restrict abortion. And we've seen a whole host of proposals to restrict it more this session at the state legislature. Regina, let me start with you here. We're expecting to see reproductive rights groups kind of challenge many of these restrictions that are already on the books in the court. We saw a judge rule the existing law that restricts abortions to 15 weeks was struck down just last week. But is a showdown kind of set up, you think, in the state legislature in terms of further restrictions moving forward?
I do think it's never going to end. I think this is something that we're going to be continually seeing at the state capitol. It's going to be a showdown for many years to come because you have two very heartfelt groups and the pro-life and the pro-choice, and they're neither one of them is going to give up.
Tom, what about the Democratic strategy here? Because we're seeing Democrats take a legislative approach to try to repeal some of the restrictions through the legislature as opposed to through the courts. Could that be successful? Are they kind of banking on 2026 here?
I think they are, but I don't know that it'll be so successful. I think if abortion rights are to be enshrined and protected in the state of Arizona, it will be through the court system. Because laws can be passed and laws can be repealed and laws can be changed. So I think what's going to happen is these cases will continue to bubble up and they will be compared to the what's been enshrined in the Constitution now by Prop 139. Because whatever's in the Constitution controls. And so the courts will be looking at legislation that's on the books now or legislation that gets passed and see whether or not it comports with the language of Prop 139 or not. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be the tail of the tape. I do see both parties are going to continue on with the fight over what is abortion rights or what is not abortion rights because it plays to the base of both parties, and it's a way of generating political capital, cash.
Yeah. How much does it play to the base of the Republican Party anymore, Regina? Like, because, I mean, we've definitely seen the political tides turn on the issue of abortion and the, you know, where the majority of the country stands. Even in red states, we're seeing, you know, abortion rights protected.
I think it plays to the base on both sides. I think that, and I think that's why they keep using it. Mm. This is probably not going to be as effective, I think, in the future as it has been in this last election. I perceive the public as saying, it's done. Let's move on and let's figure out something else. And I think that, but they, neither side is going to give up on this one.
I think what's going to happen here eventually is that science and medicine will get to the point where they will be able to eliminate the need for most abortions. Now, there are abortions that have to happen because of a miscarriage, ectopic pregnancy, things like that. Those will still continue on, but I think you'll see different types of contraceptive come in. We see this all the time in medicine. We, you know, find a cardiothoracic surgeon anymore. It's hard to because we've moved to statins, we've moved to stents, we've done all these different things that you don't need to crack a chest and do, you know, coronary bypass. I think you're going to see the same kind of development go on with the issue of reproductive care.
And there is the restrictions after fetal liability that might be the new kind of battleground, it sounds like, where the law is less clear based on 139, right?
Yep, exactly.
Agreed.
All right, I want to move on to talk about the ongoing debate over just how Democrats should respond to the new Trump administration after he won this kind of decisive victory in November. We're seeing some of this start to take shape this week. Ruben Gallego, I think, has emerged as a very interesting figure in that debate, doing these kind of national interviews about Latino men and what they really want and why they voted for Trump. You know, he supported, co-sponsored the Laken Riley Act, things like that. And then last week we saw the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, a very likely future presidential candidate, it sounds like, take a big leap away from the progressive left. And in his new podcast, his first guest, Charlie Kirk, they talked about transgender athletes in sports. And Newsom said, you know, the idea of allowing transgender athletes to play in women's sports was deeply unfair. This really riled up the left, Tom. Talk a little bit about your reaction to that.
What's happened here, and that's it. First off, I'm going to challenge one thing. I don't think Trump won as an overwhelming mandate. He did win. Let's be clear about that. But he won with less than 50% of the vote. But he's still the president of the United States. So let's talk about what's going on with the Democratic Party. They are in disarray. They are having a hard time understanding what is the right response. It isn't Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania. It isn't Governor Gavin Newsom. And by the way, he's going to have Steve Bannon on his podcast too now.
Yeah.
What's happening is what used to be the normal Republican Party has shrunk. And what's taken over is this metastatic form of Republicanism known as MAGA, M-A-G-A, Make America Great Again. But there's this vast political field now that has been left open. And Democrats are moving to the right to fill that void and seeing that there might be some political value and gain to that. It's going to tick off the base when we see that going on. I don't see that as the world's greatest strategy. I think there's a lot that's been abandoned by what used to be traditional Republican values. For example, defending Ukraine, NATO, things like that, you know, defending veterans, those kinds of things. I think, you know, the Democrats should step up and take over. But going far over to the far right into these hot button social issues like the transgender athlete issue, I think, is a dead-bang loser for a Democrat doing that.
Regina, what's your take there from the Republican side of this? Like, you're watching maybe Democrats kind of try to play some of those issues to the center or maybe a little bit to the right. Do you think there's open ground to be filled from, you know, the void that's been left by where the traditional Republican Party used to be?
I think there is an open ground to be filled. But if you look at our state right now, the majority of the voters are independent. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It's independent. Now, you have within the Republican Party those that are way right and those that are middle. I think that piece I don't think you're going to change the mind of those people. I think where you're going to be changing the mind of and where the Democrats feel that they didn't do a good job is that largest sector of our population, which is the independents.
So Tom, like, what should they be focusing on? Yeah.
Let's do some basics. Number one, let's not be firing veterans. Let's stand up for the veterans. Let's stand up for the most successful military alliance in the history of the world, NATO. Let's quit attacking our friends and neighbors in Mexico, Canada. Let's quit talking about attacking Greenland and Panama and taking them over. Stick to those kinds of issues, and then stick to sensible governing. I think Trumpism will collapse, but if you start trying to mimic them, you can't out-Trump Trump. The candidates that have tried to be Trump-like have not done well. Exhibit A, Carrie Lake. Others that have tried to do the same thing, it doesn't work. You can't be Trump. You can't be MAGA. It's him. He can do that, but nobody else should be doing that.
I want to ask you lastly, Regina, about another figure we should bring up here. Senator Mark Kelly posted on X about his trip to Kyiv this week in support of Ukraine and was called a traitor by Elon Musk, and kind of this threw this debate back into the political spotlight. And who should be the leader here? Do you think somebody like Mark Kelly would be able to fill that ground?
I don't think Mark Kelly is going to be filling that ground, but I do think that calling Mark Kelly a traitor was not a great idea. Mark Kelly is one of our most well-renowned veterans and astronaut. This is not a man that's a traitor.
Yeah. I wonder, what do you think then, if you were advising the other party, which you don't have to, but what do you think they should be focusing on?
They should be focusing on what Trump won on, which is border security, making fairness across. When we talk about the tariffs, one of the things I think he's hitting home with is that they've been charging us tariffs for years, and we haven't been reciprocating it. I think those are the things that we need to look at. And you're saying attacking, but if you're going to do a tariff on somebody, let's have an equal footing. Let's not try to overdo it or underdo it. But let's get on an equal footing.
Yeah. All right. We will have to leave it there for today. That is former state Republican lawmaker Regina Cobb, attorney Tom Ryan joining us. That is the Friday Newscap. Thank you both for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The Trump administration's ongoing attempt to eliminate DEI initiatives recently found its way to our backyard here at KJZZ. A few weeks ago, the Maricopa Community College District, which holds our license, announced a series of new policy changes to comply with President Trump's executive orders. Kate Moeller teaches English at Mesa Community College. In addition to her teaching work, Moeller, until recently, served as the president of Ability Maricopa, an affinity group for college employees to talk about living with disabilities. Moeller recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about the impact of the policy changes on her experience with the group. And we want to stress that she's speaking here from her own perspective, not as a representative of the district.
Ability Maricopa provided a lot of social activities for employees. We liked to get together and, you know, simply talk about our experiences, our diagnoses. We shared a lot of resources. We taught each other about different approaches to our diagnoses. We made friends, and it gave me the opportunity to serve others, which I really appreciated.
Right. I mean, if I'm hearing you right, these were rooms and spaces where you knew you were speaking to a group of people who were going to have shared reference point for a lot of things that come up when you're dealing with a disability, particularly in the workplace, I would guess.
Yes. And a lot of us had never had the opportunity to communicate and, you know, hang around other folks like us, you know, other like-minded people who had disabilities, who, you know, some of us were struggling, some of us were thriving, and we learned from one another.
Can you give me an example? Obviously, you don't have to identify anybody, but of the range of what disability meant in those rooms?
We had members with an array of disabilities. You know, your physical disabilities, blindness, or hearing impaired. But recently, we've been learning about neurodivergency. And a lot of us were surprised to find out later in life that we had neurodivergencies, such as autism or bipolar disorder or ADHD. These days, parents take their children to doctors and they get diagnosed with certain disabilities. But I have encountered quite a number of people who, for instance, have discovered that they're autistic when they get their child diagnosed.
Oh, wow.
So,
and so that, if I'm hearing you right, is the kind of unique experience that is only just starting to become talked about more that you might be able to share about at an Ability Maricopa meeting.
That's right. We learned so much from one another. We learned from sharing our experiences with one another. We learned to be kind to one another and tolerant and encouraging. We learned to give people what they need.
From your experience being in one of these conversations, do any particular moments come to mind where somebody shared something that changed your perspective that you then took back to work with you?
Something interesting that happened to me is that as the president of Ability Maricopa, I got the opportunity to hang out with all different kinds of people, and I made friends with a couple people who were autistic. And I was also reading this book, Neurotribes. So at the same time I was learning about autism, I was making friends with autism, and suddenly it became apparent to me that I, too, was autistic. So I actually went to a provider and went through the testing and found out that I'm autistic. And that has been very helpful in understanding my life up to this point. Uh-huh. It explains a lot.
Uh-huh.
And
you does know, it help you in your work? I would imagine it must help you in your work.
It absolutely helps me in my work because now I can ask for an accommodation, an ADA accommodation, to help me with forms and processes. I get overwhelmed and frustrated with bad directions.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to be on a mission all the time to make sure people have good directions because good directions make us produce better stuff.
Well, and as a professor, I imagine you're giving instructions a lot to your students.
I have been an instructor since 1990, and my experience in Ability Maricopa definitely helped me understand and identify with my students more. Students are so much more willing these days to step up and just say, I have autism, I have ADHD, to come right out and ask for help. And Ability Maricopa was all about empowering people to ask for help and serve one another.
So listeners will probably have noticed we're talking about Ability Maricopa in the past tense. Tell us why we're talking about it in the past tense.
Sure. What happened is that the federal government conveyed that if we didn't stop DEI programs, then we have the threat of having our federal funding removed.
And federal funding is very important to an institution like the Maricopa Community College District.
Right, right? Because our students need financial aid.
Right.
So we need federal funding.
What went through your mind when you found out that the implications of these DEI-related executive orders were going to mean that Ability Maricopa would be dissolved?
I can't speak as a representative of Maricopa County Community College District. I can only speak as a private citizen who happens to work in the district. And I do happen to be that past president of Ability Maricopa. And I was very sad because that was our community and our way of sticking together. We had a lot of solidarity in that group, and we can't come together at work anymore.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I can imagine some people hearing about something like this and saying, well, it doesn't mean that groups like this, like the folks who are in a group like this can't still get together. It just means that it can't be an official affinity group of the institution. So again, just from your own perspective, what was important about the fact that Ability Maricopa was formally affiliated with the community college district?
Personally speaking, I have been teaching online only since 2016 when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So the pandemic came along and I had already been online only for 4 years. And I had grown used to being alone. And when the district started offering all kinds of online offerings, I got excited because I finally had people to interact with, you know, during work time. I had friends, you know, I had colleagues again. And, you know, some of us continued to live pretty isolated lives because that's what disability does sometimes. So we had really appreciated the opportunity to have a voice and have our activities and be able to collaborate with students. There are a great deal of people who deserve a chance, who don't get that chance on their own sometimes.
Well, Kate Moeller teaches English at Mesa Community College and is the former president of Ability Maricopa. Kate, thank you for telling us your story.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.